And thanks to each of our panelists. We're going to take about 15 minutes for Q&A. And we're going to start with the brief comment to the charge of providing counsel to Secretary Shulkin about actions that he can take and the department can take to lend the greatest transformational potential to interoperability throughout the nation. And Mickey, why don't we start with you and just come right down this way.
Okay. I guess the one thing I would say and strongly recommend, which I think is what you're doing, but I'll say it anyway, is to be, you know, as actively engaged as possible in the market-based healthcare delivery activities and do that in industry standard ways. So, you know, there's two pieces to that. One is participate actively in the networks that are really getting traction, Commonwealth Care Quality, but also do it in alignment with the way that that is an industry standard rather than, you know, we've had experience of the federal government coming in to exchange activities and setting a higher bar for reasons that aren't clear to the market and that end up becoming real barriers to exchange. And we've seen that in direct messaging, for example. But I think that, you know, for at least for, you know, from my perspective, the government's role as a market participant and furthering the, you know, sort of interoperability through its market activity, through VA, DOD, Indian Health Services, CMS, are much more powerful and enduring than a regulatory approach.
Thank you, Mickey. Julia?
So I think my advice would be to really think about once information arrives in your system, how to get it to change a clinical decision. I think that's the part that we just know the least about now. How do we present that information? How do we make it meaningful and usable and integrate it with all the other information that person's going to be looking at? And I think thinking about how in your procurement strategy you can ensure that that piece is done as seamlessly and frictionlessly as possible.
Thank you, Julia. Chris?
Well, Mr. Secretary, I would say put two-thirds of your effort into getting interoperability amongst and between the VA systems working well. I'm glad that you started with those comments because it's table stakes and it's really, really hard. I wouldn't underestimate it. And a third of your effort into aligning behind the standards the way that Mickey described and requiring them as a condition of participation in the community care operations. I think that would have a lot of influence in that community care operating well with the VA, and I think it could be catalytic to the rest of the industry.
Thank you, Chris. Chantel?
Just building on what Chris said, I was pleased to see that when you thought about the four ways in which you're sharing information, VA to community partners is a big one. We did have conversations with hospital leaders across the country last year about serving veterans, and there's a lot of goodwill and interest in being a community partner, but a lot of challenges in getting information to flow back and forth to support that care.
Thank you, Chantel. Don?
Well, I think the big thing is really to think about the national impact, which I know absolutely you're doing in a very powerful way. I would also throw out the suggestion, maybe to all of us, it's very important to think about structured versus unstructured data. Structure requires investment, human capital investment in structuring data. And you have literally millions of choice points on how much you want to invest in structure versus less structured data. And I think it's just worth thinking explicitly about how you make those investments, because I think it's very hard. And it is a source of ongoing confusion in the entire interoperability discussion to not understand how data gets structured and what the human capital investments are to do that. I know you're working on that.
Thank you, Don. That's a good segue to open it up for the whole group to raise any questions or comments for the panel. Yes, Anish? And could you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Anish Chopra, and my question is about gaps and procurement strategies to address gaps. So let's describe the gaps. One is you're buying a system as is. So let's just call that for this discussion an EHR product that's supported in full production. But then you see on the other extent aspects of communications that are specified but may not be in full production today. And let's just describe that in this case as being
the capacity for patients to access their health data akin to the Argonaut Project specs. We'll call that the Apple announcement, Mickey, in your timeline. I want to be Apple ready, but I've got a vendor that's got products that may not be out of the box Apple ready. A procurement question is, how does one address who closes the gap and whether that gap is closed by custom development or whether there's an alternative mechanism for a standards-based approach so that you don't have to bear the entire cost burden to close that gap if you wanted to be Apple ready before your vendor allows. Any reaction on procurement strategies for the gaps?
Chris, you want to take a first cut at that?
Sure. Well, Anish, I'm not sure that there's a one-size-fits-all answer. I think the idea would be, you know, if we're smart, we'll try to negotiate in contracts with core vendors that they'll provide openness generally to make things future-proof so we can anticipate some new developments. In this particular instance, you know, this is a place where I think the innovators will go faster than the legacy vendors, not with any disrespect to legacy vendors, but they have to do 1,000 things. A point solution can do one thing. Great. Let's just have that that new entrant do that one thing exceptionally well, but I'll put the burden on my legacy vendor in a future-proofing way to make sure that they're ready for those things as best we can anticipate in the future.
Would one of the other panelists like to comment on this? Mickey?
Sure. It's an ongoing discussion that we have. I think it's really tough. I mean, I guess just to offer a little bit of a counterpoint to what Chris said, it's really hard. It's really hard when you get out of sync with what's going to work in a production sense for these, for the vendors' long-term, sort of business operations. And in some cases, I think, I've certainly had examples in our experience in Massachusetts, for example, when Direct first came out. Direct came out as a standard. There was a long lag before the vendors had actually implemented the specification and figured out how they were going to architect it. Were they going to be their own HISPs? Were they going to participate, use SureScripts as a HISP? Were they going to, do something else? Were they going to allow their users to choose their HISP? And it turned out that there was highly varying in the market. But we, with the Mass Highway, which is a statewide HIE, we decided, well, you know what? We're going to get out ahead of that. We're going to build custom direct solutions as, sort of middleware to solve that, to fill that gap. That ended up, I think, in hindsight, we're going to say that ended up costing us a lot more, and at the end of the day was probably not the best solution because now we're trying to tear some of that back to build it more, directly into the solutions that the vendors ended up putting out. We had one vendor in particular who changed their approach 3 times in the middle of this, so we had to change our approach 3 times. That was eClinicalWorks. They changed their approach 3 times to the way they were going to implement Direct.
Thank you, Mickey.
So that's a challenge.
A quick retort response by Chris, and then over to Janet.
No, I actually agree with Mickey, but temporary kludges have to be temporary. That's the problem. They have to be deconstructible.
Janet, that's good. Could you introduce yourself?
Hi, Janet Marchibroda with the Bipartisan Policy Center. Chris, you talked about something called incongruent regulation, and Chantal, you had that terrific slide. I wish I could have taken a picture where you showed the various kinds of regulatory burden. I'm hoping the panel might talk about, can you share, based on your knowledge, where we do have incongruent regulation that sort of gets in the way of interoperability, or are there other opportunities for regulatory reform that can help achieve the goal that we all want to achieve?
Chantal, would you like to make an initial comment, and then perhaps Don, we can ask you to chime in.
You want me to go first, huh? I think there are ways in which the meaningful use criteria are right now potentially getting in the way, and I'll just give one example of interpretation. So many healthcare organizations are now simply allowing shared access to the record that they have. They don't actually want to share the data and send it from one place to another. They'd rather allow access to the information that they have in one place. When you do that, it doesn't actually count as getting credit under meaningful use for sharing information with other providers. So there's a very simple example where people are actually moving beyond what some could argue is a systematic temporary kludge, which is Direct in the first place. We may get beyond that. We may always need it. But I don't think
people envision it as the primary way of sharing data over the long term. And they've moved beyond that, and yet the regulatory requirements say you still need to send this thing via secure email.
Thank you. Don, do you want to add anything?
Well, Jen, you know, I think, first of all, it's a challenge. So the American healthcare system has spent 50 years outside a market economy. So, you know, where, you know, marginal price does not equal marginal cost. And so without market prices, the entire creation of every hospital, med school, and delivery system has a certain odd non-market sense to it that we all live in. So when we talk about regulation and deregulation, you know, it's a very funny kind of tortured context. The clearly, I think there are some things that potentially can be addressed in meaningful use. It's a complex stack, as we all know. A lot of it is written in law. We're certainly, from an administration point of view, trying to look at how that sort of plays out in 2018. From a go-forward point of view, let me point out a couple things that, at least from the ONC point of view, we think minimize the drag of regulation. So first of all, the Open API, FHIR, RESTful, JSON, is really an industry standard. It is a pretty thin type of rule. We're really focusing on the read part of it rather than the read-write part of it. Right, so essentially structuring a query in front of the EMR rather than digging deep into the innards, which puts it into an entirely different cost and regulatory profile. So I want to, you know, it's a very subtle technical point, but it's extraordinary in terms of vendor effort and institutional effort potentially. So we're trying to go very, very light there. And obviously the hope with the Trust Exchange framework is that, as Mickey outlined, these things will coalesce, again, in a way that has minimal federal regulation in terms of the structure of how those things come together. So I just wanted to point out a couple things we're doing to absolutely tamp down that. There are some places where you can sort of, I think, argue more for regulation. Chris mentioned in the core data set for interoperability, at some point you have to decide what are the core pieces of data that you want as a country to share, and that we are working hard to build a consensus on what those things are. You know, or does that include the various quality measures? What is that minimal thing that we as a country want to invest a lot of money in? So I don't know, that hopefully Jen gets at some of the sort of regulatory profile, but we're absolutely thinking about that and, you know, trying to think about it in a Friedrich Hayek kind of way for anybody who's a fan of Austrian economics.
Thank you very much, Don. Just two other last quick comments before we go to break or questions. Stephanie? Thank you, Stephanie. We might want to leave that as the last word, but I think we'll go the last word to Joe. As you wish. Just tell us who you are. Secretary is for every company to make a pledge to share their data. Because
Because this similarity, which the plug and play of PCs and laptops and medical world, is that there are engineers and scientists behind it that could make it all work. And if people just weren't hoarding data, we could easily make drivers to make the data flow. And while I think he was saying we made, you know, in such a short time and there's not been enough progress, I'd argue that vital signs monitoring, blood lab data, imaging, have been on over 30, 40 years, and they don't talk to each other. So as part of Patient Safety Movement Foundation, we asked companies to make a pledge to share their data. And CMS for a while borrowed that letter of pledge, but they left out a very important sentence: share the data with whoever they use it to improve patient safety. So what I'm just asking, as you try to struggle with interoperability, which is a wonderful second step, yes, companies like to share data. And the way you can do that is disincentives with taking away reimbursement for products that don't share data.
Thank you, Joe. We'll come back to that later on in the meeting. Any of our panelists, Julia, would you like to comment on this?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, my take is that the pledge does not go very far when you're sitting in a meeting with the CFO. And so, I think you just need to be very clear. I think when you were heading into the incentives and disincentives, then I was very much in agreement. But I think voluntary codes of conduct have not unfortunately worked well in many other industries, and there needs to be that strong business case there. And so that's, I think, where I'd argue we need to continue to focus our efforts.
Thank you, Julia. And let's offer a final note of thanks to our panelists and to Secretary Shulkin for a 15-minute break.